Hello, I'm Yolanda McFarlane. This is number 0384, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0384. And this is a very special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know, last week we had a special show too, when we put together the annual broadcast of the Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is also rather unique. This is a best of show that looks back at some of the great guests we've been lucky enough to get this past year. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition. It's just going to be snippets of past interviews. We also revisit a favorite idiot of the day at the end of the program as well. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0384, was my sister, Yolanda McFarlane. And thank you very much, Yolanda, for doing the guest Slate on this program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Anyway, let's get right to the meat of this show as we look back at some of the interviews we've done over the past year on the Stuff File program. 2015 saw us talking to not one, but two former members of the cast of the hit series Happy Days. On show number 0333, at the beginning of the year, we caught up with Anson Williams, who played Potsy Weber on the classic sitcom. Williams has gone on to be an award-winning television director, writer, producer, and entrepreneur. And with a new book, he's also ventured into the kitchen. We talked extensively about his book, The Perfect Portion Cookbook, but we also had a chance to catch up with some of the other parts of his career. You are right. So busy. As I mentioned in the introduction, you're a television director, writer, producer, and entrepreneur. Did you see the writing on the wall early in your career? Because, you know, there's a lot of actors who have gone off into directing. Some of your co-stars have gone off to be very successful directors. Some people have moved behind the camera. Was that always something you wanted to do?
Very early on. You start off as an actor, and I pretty much saw my limitations pretty quickly, and I always loved writing and creating. So very early on, I wanted to get behind the camera. And Gary Marshall, you know, our boss, our mentor on Happy Days, was very, very instrumental in giving me the opportunity to follow directors around the Paramount lot, to really learn other areas of the business. He was instrumental. Paramount Studios was like a college for me. And he made that work. So I was able to take advantage of Happy Days beyond just the show and really learn a lot of other areas of the business. And in fact, the first film I ever got produced was for NBC. Ron Howard directed it. It was called Skyward. I wrote the story, and starring Betty Davis. And that was the beginning. Wow. And I started producing and writing, and then finally got behind the camera in 1985. And I've been fortunate since. Ron has a huge, huge feature career, and I've been fortunate to have a pretty good television career directing.
Now, you mentioned Gary Marshall. People, are, of course, familiar with his work. But he's also done a lot of work in front of the camera as well. I bring that up because do you find it makes you a better director having been an actor?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, incredibly. It's a great tool to have because you understand actors. You understand the process. You understand how to get in their head. You know what to do, what not to do. You're just more sensitive. You know, and performance and script is everything. And you have to be able to communicate. And as an actor, talking to an actor, it's a real asset. You know, it's funny. I got to direct Gary Marshall as an actor in Sabrina. Is that funny?
Wow.
I actually got to direct Gary. How is that for a turnaround? He makes my career from nowhere. And years later, I'm able to direct my hero.
That's amazing. So besides,
isn't that cool?
So besides this cookbook, again, The Perfect Portion Cookbook, and people can go to the website, theperfectportion.com. Besides having that coming out, what other things are you working on that we can perhaps see some of your work, either from a writing, directing, or producing point of view?
Well, right now, it's funny. We've got a few shows that we've packaged that we're selling to the network. So pretty much in development right now. And so they should be out, you know, we'll see pretty shortly what's going on. We're very involved, you know, in the product business. I mean, the cookbook's one thing, but we've been in the product business for 17 years. And, in fact, we were on QVC for 10 years in the beauty area. So I'm very involved in commerce. Mm. And then very involved with, you know, four daughters at home. And then, very interesting, Don Most, Henry Winkler, and I put together a show called Happy Days Live for fun. And starting in the summer, we're going to be touring around the country, and I think Canada, too. We're going to do a Happy Day show where I sing the songs I sang on the show. Donnie's a great performer. Henry's going to host the show. So we're going to have this great, you know, kind of back to the good time show starting this summer.
From your perspective as someone who is, again, producer, writer, and director, do you find nowadays that this could be a new kind of golden age of television from a creative point of view, what with the many outlets that are available, both online and streaming, that give you opportunity to work literally on a project from the ground up and have a little more control?
Totally. I mean, thank goodness for Amazon and Netflix and Hulu. You know, it just broke it open. I mean, it's some of the best written, wonderful material that really contribute. I think that it's great material that's worthwhile. And it's just a pleasure to have that opportunity now.
Former Happy Day star Anson Williams. Once again, his book for foodies is called The Perfect Portion Cookbook. That was originally from show number 0333. You can go to the Stuff File website to hear the full interview and more about his cookbook. In that show, he mentioned his mentor, Gary Marshall, and also his touring with Donnie Most. Well, near the end of the year, on show number 0380, we talked to Donnie Most about his music and even played some of it. Sadly, we also talked about the passing of Gary Marshall, who died back in July. Sadly, recently, Gary Marshall passed away. I had the opportunity to see you and some of your fellow co-stars pay homage to Gary on a recent episode of The Odd Couple. What was that like for you?
It was a wonderful time. As you know, Gary created the original Odd Couple for TV, starring Jack Klugman and Tony Randall. And then he was a consultant on this new updated version with Matthew Perry, Thomas Lennon, and he played Oscar's dad, Matthew Perry's dad, in an episode, and they were planning to do some more, and then sadly, when Gary passed away, they decided to write an episode about Oscar's father passing away, and then bringing back characters that his father had known and worked with over the years, and they took that occasion to bring in people that Gary Marshall had actually worked with. So it was a wonderful opportunity to pay homage to Gary, the people that, you know, owe a lot to gratitude for what he did for their careers. So on that particular episode, Ron Howard appeared, and Cindy Williams and Penny Marshall, Anson Williams and myself, and Marion Ross from Happy Days, and Pam Dauber from Mork and Mindy. And the cast, they were so gracious and appreciative and welcoming to us. And the whole thing had a very special, magical feeling to it. And I think, you know, it was all because of Gary. So it was a great, great time.
And I think Gary would have been proud.
I think so. Yeah. I really do, yes.
Just a snippet of our chat with Donnie Most. You can hear more of the interview on show number 0380, and you can find out more about Donnie and his music on his website at donniemost.com. What would the Stuff File be without some guests who you might consider to be on the quirky side? Well, we had a fair number of those. Mike Wolf from Idaho has an extremely hairy back. But he's not hiding it. Thanks to his friend Tyler Harding, he's turned it into art, which you can display year-round on Calendair. That's CalendHair, Calendair. He appeared on show number 0337, where he explained how this started as a hairy tank top.
I was actually the best man in a wedding in 2007. And we were going to Hawaii, so I went over to a buddy's house, and I had him shave around a tank top. And so I went to Waikiki Beach and threw off my shirt, and I had a hair tank top, and everybody was laughing, and we had a good time with it. So then my birthday is actually July 4th. And in 2008, I called up my same friend that would shave, you know, shave that tank top, and I said, hey, we're going camping this weekend. I need an American flag in my bag. He just started laughing. As you can imagine, he's like, well, I think I could do something like that. And so he came over on the 2nd, shaved in the American flag, and then we went camping that weekend, and it was a huge hit. And I just kind of flowed from there.
Okay. I'm looking at the pictures, some of the pictures that are on your website, and I see the American flag one. First of all, how long does it take your friend Tyler to do the artwork on your back?
It takes about an hour to draw it, because we, you know, we want to make it right. So we'll draw it in, we'll go and sketch it in, and then it only takes about an hour or more to shave it. Okay. Depending on the one for December, which is my favorite one, which is away in a manger, right?
Right.
And so it's the nativity scene, and that one took about 2.5 hours because there's a lot of intricate detail.
Now, I've seen the video where he's doing the artwork on your back, and I'm assuming that you're not at all ticklish.
I actually am, but I'll tell you what, a guy with that kind of back hair, your back itches 24/7, so it feels good, actually, to have it itched a little bit for about an hour and a half.
Now, you're also using some of the proceeds for this calendar to a good cause, are you not?
Absolutely, yeah. It's called Gates of Hope. It's an orphanage out of Nairobi, Kenya. And we're supporting kids through education and medical needs.
How did you come about choosing that particular event or that organization for your charity?
Well, a buddy of mine from college, his name is Mike Hammer. He went over there for his internship and just fell in love with the kids, you know, and his heart went out to the kids. So he came back and was passionate about it. So we started supporting that orphanage in 2002, you know, very, very lightly, because, I mean, we're all either still in college or just graduated college, so there's not a lot of means that we had. And so we're trying to support them with whatever we could. And over the years, as we're all, you know, growing in the workforce, it's just become more and more. And then this idea came about, and I said, hey, let's do the proceeds to get these kids educated. Okay. And everybody loved it. So that's how it came about.
The very hirsute Mike Wolfe, who has turned his back hair into art. Meanwhile, two guys from North Carolina, Alan Whitman and Andrew Masters, have created something called Liquid Ass. Basically, it's a fart spray. How does this idea even come up? Were you guys, like, you know, drinking at a bar one night and said, you know, we've got to invent this?
Well, actually, it was invented by accident back when I was in high school, and this is Alan Whitman. You know, one thing led to another. I went to college, went and got an engineering job, and we were having some issues with the managers and some things that were going on. We were about to be laid off. I decided to bring some in to work, and I guess the rest is history after that. That's when Liquid Ass was formally named and created.
Okay, so you say you invented this by accident in high school. A lot of things have been invented by accident. What were you trying to make when you came up with Liquid Ass?
Well, I can't really get into that, but I can tell you that it smells nasty and it's actually safe, which is the unique thing about Liquid Ass.
At what point did you say, you know, this is a product that we can sell, there's a need for this out there somewhere? What kind of R&D did you do or marketing to find out that there was a market for your product?
The first market was us, because, you know, I ran into our paths crossed working for an engineering department in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we didn't like our managers, and Alan kept talking about the stuff he had in high school, and he still had a little bit left, and he kept talking about how he's going to bring it in one day, and one day he did, and we used it, and we pretty much had a 9,000 square foot area smelling like ass for about 4 hours. And, that started the product testing and market testing, I guess you might say, where we were just having a blast for 3 months. And one day I said to the Whitman here, I said, hey, I said, this is the best stuff I've ever used. I said, we should sell this.
Yeah, I looked at him. I said, well, maybe we should. And and then one thing led to another. We decided to go in on a partnership and just sort of head down that road and see where it went.
Well, I think the quote of the day is, it's the best stuff I've ever used. And my first question to that is, compared to what?
Well, you know, I like doing pranks in college, and you know, I had my fair share of them. And one of them that I tried was the original fart spray that you get at Spencer's or used to. And, you know, that just didn't do anything. You know, I used it. Yeah, it smelled. But I had hit a guy's room, went in there a half hour later, and it didn't smell. And, you know, so I ended up spending $5 for a prank that didn't do anything. But as far as just not, when I say the best thing I've ever used, as far as any prank involved, you know, you just have, as far as pulling pranks, you can do it anonymously. It's effective. It gets everybody's attention, and you're laughing, and no one knows about it, so you can do just like the shampoo instructions and repeat.
Now, I said in the introduction that you came up with this novelty product, but it now has, after checking your website, a very legitimate use. You were contacted by people involved with the military, were you not?
Yes. Stu Segal from Strategic Ops, He contacted us, and apparently they have a triage operation where it's a simulation where they train Navy SEALs and military personnel. And I guess it works really well when they're doing, like, I don't know, bowel injuries and things like that, where they got to simulate people going and picking them up and working on these mannequins. So they want the smell to make it ultra realistic. And he's got like a studio set that's, I don't know, it's sort of like Hollywood in a way, I guess. They've got the buildings, they've got the little tower, they've got the call to prayer and all this stuff going on, because they were doing some type of Iraqi type stuff when they were doing it. And it just it really makes it real. And we also have companies that buy it for, I guess, college training kits, you know, for bowel surgery and whatnot.
Do you guys have families? And the reason why I bring that up is, I mean, you're engineers, and you say, you know what, we're leaving all that behind us, and we're going to start a company that's called Liquid Ass that sells a fart spray. I mean, what did family and friends say when you said what you were embarking on?
Well, I think it's pretty reasonable that somebody would go out and sell ass for a living. I mean, my parents were skeptical if it was a good idea or not. Now my dad uses it at the horse track when he goes in Florida and just has an absolute blast with it. So he's definitely on board. My wife was, she was less than happy about it at the time. And I told her that, if we made money with it, then I'd take her back to Jamaica where we had gotten married at Sandals and the Grill. And, 2 years later, we made our first dime, and I did make good on that promise. And, she's definitely on board with it now. And It's now how I make a living. So it's sort of living the dream.
On the other hand, my wife thought it was a great idea, and now I'm divorced.
Alan Whitman and Andrew Masters, creator of Liquid Ass. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0384, and you'll find links to their website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special best of edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the interviews we've done over the past year. There is a small beer maker in Melbourne, Australia, owned and operated by three engineers called 7 Cent Brewery. They launched Belly Button Beer, perhaps the first beer in the world fermented from yeast captured from the brewer's belly button fluff. One of the beer makers is Matthew Boosted.
A couple of years ago, Rogue Brewery from the States released a beer called Beard Beer, and that one was fermented with yeast that they captured from the brewer's beards. And I remember having it at the time and going, oh, that's quite interesting. And a lot of people being weirded out, grossed out by it. And we thought, well, that's interesting. What else could you get yeast from? And after a few more beers, we started throwing around different ideas. And we thought, belly buttons, that's a pretty interesting spot to get yeast from, something that will really challenge people, really gross some people out, but we thought it was the right balance. We didn't want to go too much further down south, so that's where we came up with the idea, and then we gave it a crack, really. So yeah.
And for the record, and I like the way you put that, there are some people who have gone further down south, and let's just leave that alone for now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mentioned in the introduction, there are three of you guys. I would assume that the lint came from either at least one or all three of you. I mean, how did you, what's the process involved here?
So what we actually did was we swabbed each other's belly buttons to get the lint in a sterile little swab, and then started growing up yeast from that. So we actually had three different cultures, one from each of us. And after going through the process to make sure that we were growing up yeast, so we actually plated out on an agar plate, and you can see yeast colonies, you can see other things growing as well, and then picked out the actual yeast colonies from each of our belly buttons, grew that up to a quantity that we could actually do a little test batch, just a 5-liter test batch, and we actually sampled each of us. So essentially we had a Brendan, a Doug, and a Matthew, or a Bowser beer. So we sampled each one and decided which one tasted the best, and that's the one we've run with for this beer. So yeah, it was pretty fun.
Okay, so are you allowed to say whose belly button lint this came from?
At the moment, we're asking people to guess. So once the beer is actually released, we're asking people to guess who they think it's come from. Don't know what they're going to base that on, but that's the idea. And we've got some plans for future for the three strains of belly button beer. So we're going to keep that one a bit secret at the moment, but we're hoping to do something interesting with that.
Okay, so while you won't tell us whose lint this is the genesis of, what was the process like? I mean, how difficult was it for the other two to realize that they were not the chosen one, so to speak? And conversely, did the third lord it over the other two?
Yes, the third definitely lauded it over the other two. It was interesting doing the taste, because although you wanted your belly button to win, it was pretty obvious. We thought that for the festival that we're releasing this at, that the characters from this yeast were the most interesting for the type of beer we wanted to make.
Matthew Boosted from 7 Cent Brewery, makers of belly button beer. On show number 0369, we met Lainey Morse. She has a farm in Oregon where you can do yoga with goats. There is always that go-to question, Just how did this all get started?
Well, I auctioned off a kid's birthday party for a charity function, and all the kids are playing, and the parents are standing out in the field with the goats, and one of the moms was a yoga instructor, and she says, you know, I should have a yoga class here. And I was like, yes, that is a great idea. Goats and yoga totally mix. And so we scheduled a date, and it was such a hit that I have people in Italy and London emailing me wanting to be put on a wait list, or, you know, if they're coming into from California to go on vacation, they want to make sure they do goat yoga. So it's been absolutely more than I ever would have dreamed of.
Now, you're saying you're getting these emails coming from all over the place. To your knowledge, are you the only place in the world where goat yoga takes place?
As far as I know, when you Google it, there is an instructor who does yoga with her baby goat. But as far as I know, anything that's set up like mine is, I think it's the first. It has to be with all this attention.
Now, give us a visual for all this. First of all, the goats you have there, I believe, Nigerian dwarf and pygmy goats. So what is the size of a full-size goat at your farm?
The full-size goats are around 35 to 40 pounds. I do have one full-size boar goat who is going to be in someone's freezer, so now he lives at my house. But he's a super sweet guy. You know, people are doing yoga in the field, and the goats just kind of wander between them, sit on their mats, you know, kind of hoping to be pet. Sometimes they climb on top of them. It's really funny, and it's really relaxing. It's just a really unique experience.
Okay, so I must confess, I'm a complete city guy, so you're going to have to walk me through this a little bit. The idea of the fact that goats sometimes do what goats do, how does that work out in a yoga situation when you're on your mat?
Well, it makes for some laughter, that's for sure. You know, this is a farm. These are farm animals. You know, things are going to happen. And if you're coming to goat yoga with any reservations of getting maybe dirty, you probably shouldn't come. But actually, last time, that didn't happen. There was no goat pellets on any mats whatsoever, and everyone was on their best behavior, so it was nice. I even had four chickens and a barn cat out here checking things out.
Wow. Okay, so how large was the first class? How has it grown? And how often are these classes?
The first class was about 30 people, and I had to cap it. I don't have a very big driveway. Otherwise, I probably could have had 100 or more. I'm not sure. The next two classes that I have are all booked already. And so I have a massive waiting list of probably a few hundred people. I think I need to probably have some goat yoga retreats in my future.
Oregon farmer Lainey Morse, who started an interesting business offering up goat yoga classes. Another interesting guest was Davey Rothbart from show number 0362. He's the guy behind Found Magazine and the subsequent Found Podcast. It's a very interesting idea of delving into the backstory of found items.
Found Magazine first started about 15 years ago. I was living in Chicago, and what happened was I came out to my car late one night, and I saw on my windshield a note addressed to Mario. Now, my name's Davey, so I'm like, all right, who's Mario? What's this note all about? I opened it up to read it, and it said, Mario, I hate you. You said you had to work, then why is your car here at her place? You're a liar. I hate you. I hate you. Signed Amber, P.S., page me later. And, you know, I was just caught by this note because, first of all, she obviously left it on the wrong car. You know, she thought my car was Mario's car, that he was cheating on her or something. But then just all these complicated emotions. She was so angry and upset with him, but still kind of hopeful and sweet. You know, P.S., page me later. And so it just made me think about all the notes and letters I'd sort of seen blowing down the street over the years. maybe a kid's drawing, maybe a Polaroid you find in the gutter or on the floor of the city bus. So I decided to start Found Magazine. It's kind of a way for everybody to share what they were finding with everybody else. You know, to-do lists, post-it notes, grocery lists. But each one gives you a little glimpse into someone else's life.
Now, so, it's one thing to start this idea of a magazine. It's one thing to start collecting stuff like this for a magazine. But did you ever in a million years think people would actually send stuff into you?
Well, I did not think it would expand at the in the ways that it did. Like, I knew a few friends who are weird like me and sort of curious about other people's lives. And, you know, I thought maybe some of them – my initial idea was to make 50 copies of this, you know, just a little handmade zine basically. But what was really stunning to me was the way that it grew and how quickly, you know – people began sending finds in from all over the country, all over the United States, and really all around the world. We had our website, foundmagazine.com, and that, so we started posting new finds every day on the Found Magazine website. And yeah, it was, I have to say, it was kind of stunning. But it was exciting to see that, you know, this idea of, you know, just getting a real glimpse of people through these found notes, you know, that it resonated with so many people.
Now, getting back to Mario, and was it Amber?
Yes.
Did you ever get in contact with either or?
Well, I never was able to find them. I wish she had left her pager number so I could have paged her and explained, you know, the mistake. But in a way, Mario and Amber is what really sparked the idea for the Found podcast. So over the years, we've published so many letters in Found Magazine and in these Found books. And there are people I've always wondered about and sort of wished I could reach out to and hear the real story behind their note. You know, part of the fun is just imagining what the story is. But a few times people have said, hey, that's mine. You know, they've recognized their found letter in the magazine, and getting to talk to them has been kind of magical, you know. So with the Found podcast, what we're doing is taking these letters. Some of them literally were found 10, 15 years ago, some of them more recently. But I'm tracking down the people who wrote them and discovering their real stories.
Davey Rothbart, the guy behind Found Magazine and the Found Podcast. You should listen to his show. It really is fascinating. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best-of retrospective look at some of the interviews we've had over the year. That's coming up in a bit.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Like the old song says, it's the most wonderful time of the year. So, in keeping with the spirit of the season, I'd like to talk about one fun way you might be able to use some of those gifts you'll be getting to make it even more wonderful. Because, in addition to being a wonderful time, it's also the most warningful time. That's right, most of those gifts you'll be getting come loaded with warning labels, and some of them are downright wacky. As host of the annual Wacky Warning Label Contest, I know that many of the labels that people have sent us over the years were found during the holidays. One label was even found right on a live Christmas tree. It warned, not intended for human consumption. Now, let's be fair, I can understand the need for a warning like that on some of the fruitcakes I've tasted, but on a live Christmas tree? Come on. If you find a wacky warning label and would like to enter our contest for a chance to win the $1,000 grand prize, find out how at centerforamericatv.org. And from all of us here at the Center for America, happy holidays.
Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to a special year-end edition of The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This is our year-ender, the best of The Stuff File program, featuring snippets of some of the interviews we had this year. On a more serious note, on show number 0342, we caught up with Leslie Udwin, the documentary filmmaker behind the controversial BBC film India's Daughter, about the 2012 fatal gang rape of a woman in New Delhi. The film includes an interview with one of the rapists who blamed women. India's Daughter was banned last year from being shown in India. Leslie Udwin talked to us about the issue on the program. We all saw the news, and at the time that the story was big in the news, I was a television news anchor, so we were covering it on a regular basis, and it's harrowing to see what was going on It had to be even worse when you decided to delve into it and talk to several of the people involved in this story.
Yes, well, in fact, surprisingly enough, Peter, it wasn't the gang rape itself or the horrific detail of that motivated me to go there. It was actually the response to that gang rape. It was seeing these extraordinary numbers of men and women, and I must stress men and women, who poured out onto the street. This was the most admirable, exciting, awe-inspiring display of, you know, a momentous passion. This was civil society coming out in force to say, we've had enough, we're not putting up with this anymore. We will not have our women treated this way. And that's what moved me. I'd never seen any country in the world come out with so much, you know, robust and courageous passion. So it was the optimism and the feeling that actually change was on the horizon that made me actually go out there, not the darkness of the gang rape.
But even though there is, as you say, so much optimism right now, there still is a big problem, isn't there?
Oh, yes. And I wouldn't say there's optimism now. There was optimism then. It appeared with that robust response to that particular crime, that change was at hand. Unfortunately, that kind of passion doesn't last long. And it died out after, well, an admirable month and a half, which is the longest anyone's ever protested for women and girls' rights in the world. But it did die out. And the rapes have continued relentlessly, not just in India, but across the whole world. This is not, it's very important to stress, this is not an India-centric problem. This is a problem that plagues every single country around the globe. And, you know, I am completely convinced, Peter, that rape, just like child marriage, just like acid attacks and trafficking, these are all symptoms of a disease. And the disease is a mindset. The disease is the mindset of gender inequality. And as long as we have that mindset flourishing, nothing will change.
You were talking before the break, Leslie, about the men that were responsible for this rape, and you had a chance to talk to in jail. Do you feel, because they're now behind bar, do you feel there was any hope for these guys? Can they be retrained? Can they be rehabilitated? Is it possible from such a heinous mindset?
No, I don't believe it is possible. And I wish I could say I did. But, you know, that is why partly I believe the solution is to start with a clean slate and to start with children as young as 2 and 3. Neuroscience actually tells us, Peter, that the age, the window during which a child is cognitively modifiable, in other words, the window at which they can change attitude and behavior, is between the ages of 3 and 5. And that is an absolutely crucial time. Now, these kids at 3 and 5, these rapists, have seen their fathers beat their mothers, have seen violence be absolutely a common part of their lives. It's normalized. You know, when I went out there, the media had told me, as it had all of us who read about this case, that these men were monsters. And that's what I was expecting. I was also expecting to be utterly enraged and furious with them, so much so that I decided that I had better practice on other rapists before I got to the rapists in this case. And the reason for that is that I was raped myself when I was 18. And I thought that all these ghosts would kind of emerge in me and I might just even physically assault one of them. I was really, really frightened of that. If I tell you, I didn't feel one second of anger as I sat for 31 hours with these 7 men, one of whom, the one, you know, I had practiced on, had raped a 5-year-old girl. And I had left a 13-year-old daughter behind when I went out to make this film. So you can imagine, I didn't feel anger. And they expressed no remorse, which was the other thing I expected, was that they would at least have a glimmer of remorse or regret. Now, why is that? Well, Put all those factors together.
Well, let me ask you a question. The thing that keeps coming to my mind, and I don't know if you asked this question of these men, but, and I think you already answered it earlier when you talked about their background, but how do they feel about their own mothers?
Well, they respect their mothers because their mothers are in a role that patriarchal society has prescribed for women. You see, there are good women and bad women. Mukesh tells us, in their view, there are good women and there are bad women. And he says only 20% of women are good. Now, you know, that society teaches him to look at a girl who is wearing a particular dress that is not traditional dress code and label her as a slut, label her as somebody who deserves what she gets, okay? Or look at a woman who is out at night with a boy, and that boy is neither her husband nor her brother. She deserves to be raped because she's clearly asking for it. Do you see, this is the mindset. They can't. It's a default with them. It's so deeply ingrained. They can't be reformed at this stage in their lives. Everything that they have witnessed and evidenced has brought them to the same conclusion. And they feel no remorse. This is the crucial thing for us to understand, because they genuinely don't believe they've done wrong. Because everything they've learned has told them, well, she deserved it. And you see how he justifies himself in this film.
Leslie Udwin, the documentary filmmaker behind the controversial BBC film India's Daughter. That was just a snippet of a much longer, intense chat with Leslie. I urge you to go back to the original show number 0342 to hear the whole thing, which was actually a rare two-part, double-length conversation. And of course, check out her movie, India's Daughter. Singer Tony Tennille is best known for her 70s and 80s chart-topping hits as half of the pop duo Captain and Tennille. Back on show number 0346, she talked about her book entitled Tony Tennille, A Memoir. It details the difficult marriage she had with Daryl Dragon and her struggle against the controlling and often bizarre behavior of her emotionally inaccessible husband. You've written this book, you've told this story, and more importantly, you were with your husband for a long time before you decided to step away from the marriage. What made you decide after that long period of time to step away, and what made you decide to write this book now?
Well, you know, it took me a whole book to explain it, so I'll try to explain it as best I can. Daryl and I were actually raised quite differently. I was raised in a very, very, very loving family. I have a wonderful, you know, loving family. My father was an alcoholic, but there was never any doubt that he adored all his four daughters. And Daryl came from a quite a different kind of family. His family was very unemotional. His father was a very, very famous symphony conductor, arranger, Academy Award winning film scorer. Their family was not at all like mine. When I met Daryl, I kind of projected onto him what I thought he could be if I could teach him how to experience the kind of love and the family love that I had grown up with. And I spent most of our relationship, it's so hard to tell you with that because I need a lot, so there's a lot more subtlety and nuance to this, but I spent most of our marriage trying to get through to him and help him experience that. Finally I realized that was not going to happen. And before I realized it, I looked up and I was 74 years old, and I was falling into this negativity that Daryl bless his heart, he had many reasons for it. But he was a terribly, terribly negative person, and I was falling into that miasma myself. And I thought to myself, well, you've got 15 good years if you stay healthy, maybe longer, hope. But I wanted to find my own happiness, and I decided to make the decision to go for it. So that's what I did.
In the entertainment world, it seems to be littered with women who have had controlling husbands involved in their life and their career. I think of Doris Day, Carol Channing, even Cher. And now we can add you to this list.
Yeah, and it really broke my heart because I was absolutely convinced I could make this happen. And also I made a vow. My vow was that I would be, you know, true and faithful to Daryl as long as we were married, which I was, which I think a lot of people from what I'm reading think is kind of, you know, ridiculous. But that was what I did. And now I'm too old to do anything else except be set in my ways. But, you know, I don't even know if Daryl realized how controlling he was. You know, we still talk to each other. I talk to him every week, check on him, see how he's doing. We had a very amicable divorce. It was very easy. We had no children, so we didn't have that problem. We just split everything right down the middle. And as long as he has people who do for him what I did for him, it didn't have to be me. Isn't that odd? After all those years, I stayed there and thought, well, I've got to do this because who would do it? But he's fine. Although I will say that I kind of think, Peter, he's looking back a little bit now and thinking about how it was. And when I told him I was going to write the memoir, which took me and my niece Caroline 2 years to write. When I look back on that, I realized that he didn't really understand what was going on. He just didn't understand it. I'm sorry I can't be more specific about it, but it's because it's hard to tell this story that it took me so long to write in just a few words.
Singer Tony Tennille. Yes, it would be hard to tell her story in just a few words. You can hear the full interview on show number 0346, and you can check out her book entitled Tony Tennille, A Memoir. Finally, it seems I discovered what for me is a new author to check out. Admittedly, when it comes to Peter James, I was late to the party. He's on show number 0359, and Peter is one of the UK's best-selling crime and thriller novelists. His Roy Grace detective novels have sold over 17 million copies worldwide. His 12th novel came out last summer entitled Love You Dead. I just love talking to him about the process that he goes through to research his novels. Since you have written these novels, are you, as a writer, learning more about the character of Roy Grace as you write, or do you pretty much have a blueprint of who he is and where he's going?
He's always evolving. I mean, Roy is, there's a lot of me in Roy. In terms of the police officer, he's very much based on Dave Gaylor, my true-life homicide detective. But in terms of Roy's attitude, there's a lot of me in it. And I get really pleased when sometimes things happen through his mouthpiece. For instance, we have a dreadful hospital in Brighton, a surreal horror hospital called the Sussex County, where you're more likely to die of what you pick up going in there than from what you brought you in the first place. And he's always slagging it off in the books. One of his officers is injured, and he's really angry that she's been taken there. And a couple of years back, I had the chief exec contacting me. He said, Mr. James, could I come and see you and try and persuade you to stop slagging off our hospital? We are making lots of changes. And I thought that was interesting.
Now, you also have your own YouTube channel. And one of the things I saw was a recent video you did talking about how you do your research to find, for instance, various ways for someone to be murdered. And I've often wondered, when you're a mystery writer, do you have to explain yourself to people before you ask these type of questions? Because they might think, well, does this guy walking around asking about the best ways to murder people?
Yeah, I often think, you know, if somebody's sitting next to me at a restaurant table and I'm having a conversation with, say, a forensic scientist asking about, you know, the best way to dissolve a human body, they're probably thinking, what am I listening to? Is this some serial killer I'm sat next to? Part of the reason that I started the YouTube channel, it's very easy. It's, we call it PJTV, and it's just if I can give you the URL, it's www.peterjames.com/YouTube. And we put all kinds of fun stuff up there, including actually how to dissolve a body is coming soon. But a lot of my readers are kind of fascinated by the research that I do. And so we've put the YouTube channel up partly to kind of give insights into the kind of background to research. And also, I think a lot of people are interested in just how authors live, what, you know, what the shape of our lives is. So it's delving quite sort of personally into my life, but I'm having huge fun doing it.
Aren't you worried about becoming a sort of how-to website?
Well, I'm putting up writing tips. If you go on the website and you click subscribe, every time something new is posted, you just get a notification. And I'm putting up a lot of writing tips because every time I do a talk, there's always a dozen or two dozen people in the audience who are wanting to write themselves, and I love encouraging and helping writers. I mean, fun enough, the central character for Love You Dead came out of a talk I was doing in a woman's prison. I do a lot of talks in prisons because it's a terrible indictment on our education system in England, but the average reading age in a British prison is 9 years old. And I'm very involved with a charity called the Reading Agency, which tries to encourage literacy. And I do, as part of that, regular talks in prisons. And the big bang for me is that I get, A, to try to help prisoners, B, I get to meet a lot of them and talk to them. And I was doing a talk in a woman's prison about 2.5 years ago, and there was this very smart, intelligent lady in the audience, an inmate in her late 40s, and she was asking very intelligent questions about literature. And I thought, wonder what you're in for. And my guess was maybe she'd kill someone drink driving, something like that. Anyway, I get to mingle at the end, and I made a beeline for her. And I never say to somebody, what have you done? It's kind of not etiquette. So I always break the ice. So I said to her, how much longer do you have to go? And she looked at me and she said, 9.5 more blooming years. And it's just not fair. As a woman did exactly what I did in London, she's only got 6 more years to go. I said, what brought you in here? She said, well, I poisoned my mother-in-law, the old bag.
Oh, wow.
I said, okay. She said, well, the thing was, she went to the hospital to die, so I embezzled her bank account. And the bloody woman didn't die. She came home, and I realized she'd find out, so I had to poison her. And then I realized my husband would find out, so I had to poison him, too.
Wow.
And when I was being taken out, I said to the officer, is this for real? He said, yes, sir. Husband was 3 months on life support. He's got permanent brain damage, and she's just angry about the length of her sentence. You have to be a character in the future Peter James book.
Not a lot of remorse there, huh?
Not a lot.
Now, you mentioned the idea of someone sitting next to you in a restaurant hearing your conversation. I would assume someone like yourself, always looking for characters, you're probably the kind of person who may be on a plane or maybe in a restaurant, or if you take public transit, might be listening to another conversation or two and you know, mentally jotting notes while you hear what other people have to say.
Oh, yeah. Do you know, one time I was sitting next to this couple and I was so intrigued by conversation. I was in an elevator, actually, and they were talking. And I actually sort of found myself following them down the street for a bit, wondering if I could catch any more snippets. It was, they were talking about somebody who died, and I kind of was getting the slight impression that one of them had been responsible. all the time. I think I love the serendipity of being a writer where you can meet somebody or bump into someone and something just clicks in the story.
Author Peter James. His latest book in the Roy Gray series is Love You Dead. It's the 12th in the series. Now, I found him so entertaining and engaging to talk to back on show number 0359, and we talked for quite a bit after the interview was done. I then started reading his work, beginning with the first Roy Grace novel. His books are some of the most infectious page-turners I've come across. They are screamingly fun. And by the way, you'll also find all the links from every guest we've had in this special edition of the Stuff File program on this week's What's On page. Again, that's show number 0384. I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off, so let's get to it. It's now time for our retro idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
This year's Idiot of the Day grand prize winner for 2016 comes from show number 0339, and it still makes me laugh reading it again. It didn't take Boston police long to track down three suspects in an armed convenience store robbery. Authorities say the men were all wearing court-ordered GPS devices for unrelated cases, which placed them inside the Dorchester store and allowed investigators to track them to an apartment a block away. Police say the suspects entered the store at 6 p.m. All three wore masks and one had a gun. They made off with cash and cigarettes. All three pleaded not guilty at their arraignment. Two had their bail revoked in prior cases. A third was being held on $50,000 bail. The prosecutor says their GPSs pinged to the store at the time of the robbery. Police also found evidence in the apartment that tied them to the robbery. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're wearing GPS monitors, would you think it prudent, along with two other GPS monitor-wearing lunkheads, to commit a crime? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0384. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0384. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.